listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Oye, ¿cómo va Los Angeles? The Library Foundation and Aloud welcome you to the beautiful Orpheum Theater for an evening with Carlos Santana. It's a rare thing to be able to recognize a musician from just one note, yet that is what defines the music of Carlos Santana, a visionary artist whose work transcends genres and boundaries. His sound has been shared with a legion of followers worldwide, from that legendary moment at Woodstock in '69 to the present day, ushering in the millennium with collaborations across generations and genres. In his words, he says, "I love creating music that connects as many people as possible." Now, for the first time ever, Carlos Santana's prolific career and life story is shared in his book, The Universal Tone, stories told with the rawness and grace you might expect from a master artist. Together with fellow authors Ashley Kahn and Hal Miller, Santana weaves the colors of his bold, unique story into a beautiful meditation on sharing creativity with integrity and passion. Beyond his work as a musician, he is committed to social justice and humanitarian causes. His Milagro Foundation donates to nonprofit programs that support the youth in the arts, education, and health. But for tonight, it's us who are the lucky ones. The stars have aligned in the City of Angels, as Carlos Santana will be joined for this special talk by Library Foundation friend and LA icon, Cheech Marin. Author, actor, director, and performer, Cheech Marin has been a lover and maker of music from the ripe age of 5 when he recorded his first record. Over the years, we've been gifted with his humor and wit, his counterculture manifestos, and remarkable contributions to the Chicano art world. He's an artist who has refused to stay typecast in any single role. Marin lent his voice to the Library Foundation's Song in the Key of LA project last year, and we are honored to have him join us again tonight to guide our conversation. Let's give a warm Los Angeles welcome to Carlos Santana and Cheech Marin on the Aloud stage.
Thank you very much. Please be seated, my children.
Gracias, muchas gracias.
It's indeed an honor and a privilege to be able to moderate tonight's festivities, honoring and probing into one of the most significant artists of our time, whose name is known worldwide. All you have to do is say Santana. Everybody knows what you mean. We're here to celebrate this book first memoir that has come out. I think that everybody has a copy of that or is supposed to have a copy of that, or I can sell you one after. or two. Keep this, so I have a handy dandy list of little questions. So, what's your favorite color?
Brown.
Well. This is a very interesting book because it takes him all the way from the time of his birth till almost now. Carlos, you were born in Autlan, Jalisco, Mexico. Yeah. Your father was a musician, a violin player.
Yes.
Not necessarily a mariachi, although he played very little mariachi music. He was in orchestras.
Only when we came to Tijuana because we had to eat.
Yeah, yeah. And from him you learned your first instrument, which was the violin.
Yes.
Your father was always on the road. a lot, and he was always mostly gone. And so your mother was basically the head of the family during that time. And typically of Mexican families, if there's any drama in the family, it's usually between the father and the son. In your case, it was between you and your mother. Mm-hmm. And that continued on through your life, and it kind of formed a lot of relationships that you had, according to your book, along the way. It set up a dynamic that was good and bad, and allowed you to go forward, because she was a tough lady and had a very strict code that she wanted you to live by, whether you realized it or not. There was the one instance where you where you write in your book, your mother was called you over, and I don't know how old you were. You were like 8, 9, 10, or somewhere around there. And then she was talking to another girlfriend of hers, and she said, "Carlos, come over here and sit on my lap." He said, "No." And bang, she smacks you in the head, rings, and says, "See, he gets mad. The other kids don't get mad when I do that." And you remembered that enough to write it in your book, so it set up this kind of... Can you talk about that bond between you and your mom?
Yes.
I didn't mean to leave you there, but that was an interesting point.
The best way to start this event is by saying, may the heavens open up and the angels bless each and every one with the deep awareness of your own light. This book and everything in it is about healing the relationship with my mother, the relationship with myself, and everyone. You know, it's about healing. My mother was supreme conviction. My father was supreme charisma. I just wanted to be like my dad. You know, everybody adored my dad. You know, he put his chin like this in the violin, and women were like, "Oh my God." and you know, everyone, women, children, they just, "Don José." And I was like, "Man, I want some of that." That's what I just wanted to be adored. I think everybody wants to be adored. You know, if you're not being adored, you become... Dolores Huerta told me this. The worst thing that can happen to you is you become cynical. Cynical is like cement. Nothing grows in cement, you know? And the opposite of cynical is being vulnerable. This book, for me, is a way of closing a lot of stories. And it is an invitation to you to... I don't want to tell anyone what to do, how to do it, or who to be, or anything like that. I do invite you to claim your own light.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. When you claim your own light daily, you're able to create miracles and blessings. Not just the Pope or the Dalai Lama. It doesn't work like that. Everyone is born with divinity in your DNA. Divinity is your DNA, you know? And the relationship with my mom was very challenging, because I am just like her, and she's with so much conviction, and so I would challenge her, and she didn't like that, you know. So for me, what was funny is when every time she was pregnant, and she was pregnant a lot, I have 4 sisters and 2 brothers. I'm in the middle. So I remember whenever she got pregnant, whenever she spanked me, it would hurt more, because she was... And a lot of pressure with my dad, you know? So I think she would take it out on me or whoever was closest. And I remember she grabbed me like this, and she goes, "Alguien, trae me un cinto. Somebody bring me a belt." And I was like, "Man, don't, you know?" So they bring the belt, and then she was right-handed, so when she was going to swing, I would run this way. So she would just hit the air, you know, "Sha, sha," you know? And that would piss her out even more, you know? So I found myself, since I was a tiny little kid, probably, I found myself running away. And I wasn't afraid to run away, and I just, you know, I can't bear the brunt of her rage. So I'm going to run away. So I would just take off. like a rabbit. I just hit it hard. And I remember being in Tijuana a couple of years where the worst part for me was Christmas, because, you know, you're alone, away from family, and you see all this Christmas shopping windows and stuff like that, and trains and stuff, and I'm pissed off, and my mom's pissed off, and I'm alone, you know. And so to me, for a long time, Christmas was not a nice thing, you know. I'm very happy to tell you that we did reconcile, and we did learn to accept one another. And when that happened, I gained the best friend, the person who prayed. And by the way, Mom, your prayers worked.
Your first instrument was the violin, which your father taught you, and you used to go around with other kids in the neighborhood. Was this in Tijuana or not long ago, you charged 50 cents a song?
Yes, in Tijuana.
And you had a violin, a guitar, and another violin?
And two guitars and one violin.
Two guitars, one violin. What were some of the songs that you played? Do you remember?
Las Mañanitas, Cielito Lindo, La Cucaracha, you know, all the, you know.
How old were you at this time?
This is 59, so I was like probably 12 or 11. Something like that.
So at some point, your family, for the whole story, go to the book because it's an interesting story. You moved from Atlanta to Tijuana, mm-hmm. and your father was working there as a musician. And during the course of living there, you discovered the guitar, and you found the instrument that you were supposed to play. My question is you discovered the electric guitar first. Yes. Not acoustic guitar, not a Spanish guitar, and it always was electric guitar. What about the electric guitar?
The electric guitar for me was like seeing the first flying saucer. Something beyond this earth, I was like, because I heard it. And this guy, Javier Bates, he had that twang, that sound, like B.B. King, Freddie King, Albert King, Michael Bloomfield, Peter Green. You know, he had that sound, and I was like, oh, shit. And I hear that sound bouncing up against, in Tijuana, in the park, against the church and the cars and the trees. And I was like, oh, my God, that's all I want to do. That's all I want to be, that. And then I went to his house because I started following him like a little puppy. I wanted to see how he got that juice, you know. And in his house, he had nothing but B.B. King records. So I said, oh.
Thank you, Mrs. King.
So I found out it was through B.B. King that this guy, Javier Bates, was a combination of three people. B.B. King, Little Richard, and Ray Charles. That's all he listened to. That's a bad dude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So your first influence, right from when you picked up your first electric guitar, was always the blues, and you learned everybody. What were some of the other blues influences that you had right from the beginning?
The kings of what I call cut and shoot music. They call it cut and shoot because if you don't play it right, they cut and shoot you. They don't want any fancy chords or any, they just want John Lee Hooker, Jimmy Reed, Lightning Hopkins. That was it for me. And then later on, Muddy Waters and, of course, B.B. King and that. But John Lee Hooker is the king of swamp music.
So you talk about in the book about being infatuated with the blues and the center of the blues. What's the center of the blues?
The center of the blues is, I think Shakespeare says, to be or not to be. Blues players don't have time for that. It's just is. Watch this. Bam! And when they hit it, you go, oh, dang. You get chills and, it's wonderful, and I respect Shakespeare. He obviously couldn't play blues to save his life,
So So blues would dominate your early playing, and like most fanatic guitar players I've ever met, that's all they did. Morning, noon, and night, practice guitar, listen to riffs over and over and over and over and over again until you got it. And you got a job on Avenida Revolucion in Tijuana, which was like the main strip, playing in strip bars, or playing in one particular strip bar.
El Comboy. That was the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
And you were how old at this time? You were how old at this time?
This is 61, 62, 63. 3 years.
Wow.
And it was before Cirque du Soleil or anything like that. I watched this, and please forgive me. I don't mean to do it disrespectful, but I watched this woman with this lady with this tassels, you know, and she had this thing of like 1, 2, 3, 4, and I was like, holy man, how does she do that? And she was just dancing, you know, and she's dancing music like by Thelonious Monk, you know, and I was like, whoa. So there's more than just the blues. You have to learn how to play music the way a woman walks, the way she articulates sassiness, conviction, like, I got something and you need it, and watch this, you know? And I was like, oh, I gotta get some of that in here, you know?
Yeah. That is, I know what you mean, man. Tommy and I started in a strip bar in Vancouver. So we got to, how do I make them laugh like that? Exactly. So you played in these strip bars and TJ, man, and it was a raucous scene. I mean, it had to be, because there's people coming in from San Diego, and they want a good time. They want to get drunk and get laid, and you're playing in front of all of them, and you're getting close to the girls, you know, because you can't help it, because there they are and there you are. And right in the middle of it, your father was still on the road. And he had gone to San Francisco to live, and he was gone for a long time. And at some point, your mom had enough, and she said, we're going to San Francisco too. And she showed up. What was that scene like?
I didn't go. I, you know, but I have to tell you something to conclude the story about this place where I worked. One time I was having dinner back in the club, and this guy who was a bully, he was the bouncer, he was a real bully, he always messed with me, always making me cry, pinching me, kicking me, you know, he's a real bully. And he's sitting next to me, and we're eating, and then I don't know what happened to him, but he was saying, well, to me, all women are whores. And I'm eating, and I go, and he just kept saying it with such viciousness. So I'm eating, and I go, your mother too? Your sister? Your wife? Your daughter? And he goes, man, I could kill you. And I says, yeah, you probably could, but you said it. So your mother too? You know? And so I learned since I was a child to not be afraid of, if you say something, you got to back it up, you know? And I stick up for women. I really, really do. You know, in my music, in my we would not be here without them. It's just impossible. You know, they can't incubate you on a microwave. You know.
So
you want others, you want done it yourself.
There you go. So you were playing at TJ. And then you moved to San Francisco, and it was kind of an uprooting thing for you, man. You didn't really want to go to San Francisco, but your family was there, and now you had this. But you kept on playing. As soon as you got to San Francisco, you had your original guitar that your brother sat on one night and broke it.
Yeah, you know, it was my brother's friend. He got a little drunk, and he sat on the guitar, broke the neck, and that same weekend, my brother came, and we were watching Dracula, I remember clearly, and Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman. Mm-hmm. That one. Yeah? And I was like, it was like 10 minutes left, and my brother goes, he turns off the TV, and says, I got to get up early in the morning to go to work, and this is too loud, and I got to go to sleep. So my sister Laura, she's like, she turns it on, he turns it off. So he pushed her, and when she fell, I punched him. And I was like, uh-oh. What did I do? My brother can really fight. I can't fight for nothing, but he could really fight. And next thing I know, you know, he fell down when I hit him. And when he came up, I had a chair like that. And my mother screamed, stop, because she came in and she goes, stop. And I was like, I had to sleep in the same bed with him, you know, like. And so he had a stake, you know, in his eye, because I bruised him. And he says, I understand what you did, man, and you were right, sticking up, you know, for Laura. But don't ever hit me again, ever, you know. Now, that happened on Friday. Monday, when I came from school, there was a brand new Gibson guitar, which is the guitar, the same guitar.
Put over here. Yeah, I see. There you go.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Well, almost.
It was the same guitar that I play in Woodstock. And he brought me this guitar. He bought it with an amplifier, and it was just standing there, shining and old, smelling good and everything. And I looked at him, and I was like, oh, man. And he goes, I just paid the down payment. You're paying the rest. He says, I'm going to take you to TikToks, and you're going to wash dishes with me, man. You're paying the rest. I said, okay, you know.
So TikToks was the restaurant that you all were dishwashers at. You,
yeah,
and your brother and a bunch of your friends.
It's right next to the new Giants Stadium. Now it's a parking lot.
Yeah, yeah. And so you had a deal cooked up with your mother that you gave her all the money that you made from washing dishes at TikTok, as well as when you were in TJ, you gave her the money there as well, just all of it, no questions. But with the caveat that she would save a little bit of each week for all the money you gave her so that you could buy a new guitar when you found the one that you wanted to buy.
This is before I went back to Tijuana and I bought another guitar. This is before I went back to Tijuana and I bought another guitar, which is the one that got broken.
Yeah.
I came here in 62 the first time, right when the Giants were playing the Yankees, you know. And
And
I went back, you know, I wouldn't eat. I was angry all the time, so my mom got fed up. She gave me $20. She says, your father's compañeros, you know, they're going to Tijuana, so here's $20, and see you later if you're not happy here. I said, okay.
But the one thing that precipitated that is that she spent the money.
She spent the money, you know, and she spent the money on, you know, of course, there's four sisters, two brothers, and also to fix their teeth because they had, you know, immigration, all kinds of stuff for us to get immigrated for the papers. So she had a reason. It's just that the way she did it, she didn't say, mijo, I'm sorry. You know, like, she just said, lo gasté, you know, that's it. You know, and I was like, oh, you know.
And then she gave you 20 bucks. If you don't like it here, here's 20 bucks, go back to TJ.
So I went to TJ, and I arrived there at Halloween night. And all I can see is, like, people dressed up like cadáveres, you know, like death and stuff. So I went to the church. I went to La Virgen de Guadalupe, right in the center of Tijuana. And I said, I got down on my knees and I said, to La Virgen de Guadalupe, I said, last time I was here, I walked from the entrance all the way to here, to this altar. And I did it because of my brother Tony, because he wanted to ask you something. And so I walked on my knees from there to there, and I didn't ask you anything, so I figure you owe me.
And so there you were, back in TJ.
Yep, and I said, all I want for you is to take care of my sisters and brothers and help me get a job tonight.
So you went back to the strip bar in TJ on your own at 15, playing an electric guitar in a strip bar in Tijuana.
when the owner of the club saw me, he goes, well, ¿tú qué estás haciendo aquí? What are you doing in here, man? He says, you know, your mom, you know, you're not supposed to be here anymore. And I said, it's okay. I got my mom's approval. So I show him this letter. And so he immediately goes, oye, you're done. Vete. You know, órale, you go over there. You know? So immediately I got the job immediately like that, you know.
That's cutthroat, right? So how long were you there until next installation?
I was there till a week before they shot Kennedy. I came back a week before they shot Kennedy in 63.
It wasn't. Am I off? So you're playing this bar in TJ, 15-year-old guitar player with strippers, and sounds like paradise to me. I mean, I don't know about it, you know, but it can wear on a fella, you know, and the hours and everything, and finally your mother got sick of it, and she came down with her brother and somebody else, and basically kidnapped your ass.
Exactly.
And took you back to San Francisco.
She took me back, and I
describe, because it's so great in the book, man. How did they do that?
Well, my mom came and she came to the front, but she told my brother, I know what he's going to do. He's going to run through the back. So you stand in the back. And so he's sure enough. So your mother's here. Whoosh, I took off. And next thing I know, my feet are dangling because my brother grabbed me. And I am so grateful to my mom. Mom, thank you.
So there's always this saying that you got to suffer if you want to sing the blues. And so I guess you did, man. You have to, at some point, pay your dues, man, in order to give it validity for what you're doing.
Suffering was because I came here and I thought everybody knew B.B. King. And instead they were playing nothing but Beach Boys. And I was like, I came here right around the same time that West Side Story came out.
Yeah.
You know, with the Jets and the Barts and all that, you know. And for me, it was a revelation that I had to start all over again in my existence, you know, going to junior high school because I couldn't speak English. My first words that I learned to speak in English was, stick 'em up. So, Roy Rogers said, stick 'em up. And I said, oh, stick 'em up, you know.
You'll never be a poor man with those three words.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Stick 'em up. So you get back to San Francisco and you're 16, right around there. First, you're still playing the blues exclusively, and you start to form bands now. You start to find other guys that are playing the blues, and you get together and you start to form your first bands. And as you get more well-known, you start playing other gigs around town and with other guys. And somewhere in the San Francisco scene starts to happen. It starts to be the center of the musical world because this hippie explosion was happening. And somewhere along the line, you meet this guy, Bill Graham. And he was instrumental in your life because he recognized your talent right away. And tell us about Bill Graham and your association.
Everyone here has someone appointed to help you open the door for you, whether it was Bill Graham or Clyde Davis. Everyone here, you have a person. The universe supplies a person who, at the right time, at the right place, they open up a big door for you. You just have to be willing to trust, you know? And so Bill Graham, it was at the right time, at the right place for me, because he started really believing in us, you know, and he's the one, of course, I'm jumping ahead. He's the first one that believed in us so much that he, if it wasn't for him, we would have never played Woodstock because nobody knew us, you know, and we didn't have a record. He trained us like a boxer, you know. We started opening up for Steppenwolf, Moby Grape, The Grateful Dead, you know, The Who. We opened up for everybody. And every time we played, they were like, dang, what kind of music is that, you know? Especially because women started, like, dancing differently, you know? Like, see, something you learn from Tijuana, you know? See, the hippie gals were dancing like this, you know, like they're catching butterflies or something, you know? And we play, and they start doing this. And all the other bands going like, damn, you know. Next thing you know, everybody has timbales and congas, you know.
And so at this time, you were the Santana Blues Band. And it wasn't necessarily, your name was in it, but it wasn't like Carlos Santana and the Blues Band. It was the Santana Blues Band. And you played a bunch of gigs all over. As a matter of fact, this is a coincidental that I was on my way out of the country at the same time going up to Canada, and I went to spend a couple weeks in Lake Tahoe. Mm-hmm. And there was a club there called the Crystal Ship. And playing at the Crystal Ship for 3 or 4 days was the Santana Blues Band. And I go, oh, I've heard about these guys, but I don't have no money to get in to see them. So me and my buddy, we used to hang out at the back door and wait for you guys to pull up in your van. And hey, can we help you with your equipment? carry your guitar? Oh, the band goes, yeah, whatever, man. We don't give a shit. And we would help them. We'd carry them in their stuff. And then we got to see the Santana Blues Band every night that they were there. And I'll never forget that.
Thank you, Cheech. Thank you so much.
So you're playing around San Francisco, and San Francisco is starting to explode, and you're playing for everybody, but still no record contract. And eventually, you got a record contract with Clive Davis, was it, at CBS or Columbia Records. And it was a big deal. And right as soon as you released that first record, you were invited to play this festival that nobody heard about. It was supposed to be in New York, and was called Woodstock. And you were just known then, just barely known. And we all know what happened at Woodstock, that catapulted you into world-renowned stardom there. And right, as most festivals go, you know, you're supposed to start at 12, you don't go on until midnight. And Jerry Garcia walks up to you and says, what time you go on? Midnight. So here, have this tap of mescaline. Oh, wise one. And so you did this tap of mescaline, and then you didn't go out till midnight or whatever, what was hours and hours later. And what did your guitar feel like when you were playing that?
He says, what time are you guys going to go on? I said, 3 bands after you. He says, we don't go on after midnight. So you're probably going to go on like 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, oh, okay. He says, by the way, you know. I said, sure. I said, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. By the time I'll be fine. You know, because I always did the math psychologically, you know. It takes 8 hours, 12 hours. Then you drink a lot of water. And then you, yeah, okay. But as soon as I did it, and then I flame on and came on where everything becomes amoeba-like with colors, a face comes over and says, you need to go on now. Otherwise, you're not going to play. And I was like, oh, dang. And there's 550,000 people. So it's the first time that I discover a mantra. Mm-hmm. I said, God, please help me. Just help me stay in tune and in time, and I'll never do this again. Over and over, God, please help, you know. And so that's what I'm chanting while I'm playing. Meantime, the neck of my guitar becomes like a slithering snake, you know. So I'm like, so when I see the video, I make serious ugly faces anyway. Yeah. Now let me tell you why people make ugly faces, like Stevie Ray and myself. People who make the ugliest faces come out with the prettiest notes.
There we go.
When you see a guy looking really good, he ain't saying shit. That's the truth.
Well, so go back and watch Woodstock now, and you'll see those faces. So very soon after that, all of a sudden the album comes out, and it's a huge, huge hit, man. And mm-hmm. Like, boom, and you're starting to be known worldwide. As a matter of fact, shortly thereafter, I was in Vancouver, and I was at another rock festival, and I had I conned my way into that one too. And I was laying back on the ground in between bands. I hear this music coming out of the speakers. And it was your first album. It hadn't come out yet. And I go, I know those guys. That's the Tahoe guys. Yeah, wow. And pretty soon the whole world was going to know the Tahoe guys, man. Yeah, because, and so you have this huge album. In those days, people sold a lot of albums. And you get your first royalty check, and you probably never saw that many zeros on a check in your life. And what did you do with your first royalty check?
When we first landed in Tijuana, we lived in La Colonia Libertad, which is like the worst place that you can live in Tijuana, you know? And I remember my mother doing her, you know, washing and stuff. And I said, Mom, someday when I grow up, I'm going to get you your own house and a refrigerator and a dishwasher. And she goes, that's nice, mijo. And I'm like, nah, wait a minute. You know, don't dismiss me like that. You know, it's like, I'm going to do that. Right, that's nice, mijo, you know. As soon as I got my first royalty check, that's the first thing I did.
Yeah. You're a good boy. You are a good boy, man. And so you bought your mother a house, and then you came out with Abraxas. What's his next album? Was that the next album? Yeah. Abraxas was the next album. A huge hit. Kept spawning these top 40 hits, and just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you were on a musical trajectory. You kept introducing rock and Latin sounds and jazz, and increasingly jazz in your music, because that's the way you were going. That's where you were progressing. It's like trying to stop somebody that has jumped off a diving board. They're gonna go in the trajectory that they jumped off in. And so you come to, what's your third album, is Caravanserai? Is that the third?
The third album was like the departure of all that. Caravanserai was fourth. And that was really leaving all that behind.
And that was strict, not strictly jazz, but greatly jazz.
There wasn't a single within 1,000 miles.
Yeah. That must have pleased the shit out of your record company at that point, man.
Bill Graham and Clive Davis and everybody saying, you're committing career suicide. And I said, man, I got to let the hamster out of the cage. You know, I can't like rubber stamp Abraxas, 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 and Abraxas. I gotta grow, you know, at the price of losing a lot of people who want you to be, you know, I have to grow. And so I started listening to Coltrane, Miles Davis, Weather Report, Herbie Hancock, Alice Coltrane. And I just grew, you know, you pay a price, you know, for expansion. Yeah. But I'd rather have that than just be rubber stamping the same thing, you know?
What you had in that time was a pause in your hit-making machine, like having records on the top 40 radio, but never till this day had you lost your audience that came to see you live. Always, always people came to see Santana because they knew they were going to get a great show. And increasingly, you start talking in the book about the influence of John Coltrane, who you never met, and Miles Davis, who you knew very well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were two giants of jazz. Can you talk about them a little bit and their music?
Yeah, you know, I was in Salt Lake early this summer, and someone said, hey, you know, can you do an interview for Neil Sean? And da da da. I said, sure, you know, and put a word. And I was doing this interview about Neil Sean, and this gentleman who was doing the interview, he showed me this plaque with all this stuff that he put together. And I didn't know that Santana is the only band next to Barbra Streisand who has had a hit in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000, and 2014. A top 10 on the radio. Somehow on the radio. Got on the radio, you know? And I was like, are you kidding? He says, no. And so he showed it to me, you know, and somehow now it means a lot. You know, it means to be, I started in 67. I'm 67, and I'm still relevant. By the grace of God, of course, by the grace of God.
During this time now, too, that you were going through a lot of different members of the band, the band just didn't stay intact with the same lineup because people went on, people had drug problems, they started going, and you started to, although your band was called Santana, it was somewhat of a collective, but you started to emerge as the leader because you had to. You had to make a decision not to play with guys that were not holding up their end. They wouldn't practice. They had a lot of problems. They were dragging the band down. So it came a famous incident where there was a vote, and you can say, you can stay with me, or you can go with these guys that have these bad habits. And the band chose to go with the other guys. And you stayed by yourself back in San Francisco. They went on to call themselves Santana and lasted about, what, 2-3 gigs? And Mike Shreve calls you up and says, man, all they're doing is calling for you. And so what emerges at this time is you have to learn how to be a band leader that makes those hard decisions. So how hard was that for you?
It was very painful to see the band take off without me. But to soothe my pain, I went to the Basin Street West in San Francisco and hung out with jazz musicians. And so I learned that they were very gracious in inviting me. After about a week and a half, you know, they call me and they say, hey, man, you know, we don't want to tell you this because it's probably bad for your ego. You're going to be tripping, and, you know, I'm like, ah. But people are really screaming for you, man. They really want you, you know. So I said, well, you need to put this cat and that kid on a plane, and then I'll go. Because those two gentlemen are supplying the band with some seriously harmful substance. And I don't want to be on a stage with zombies. I want the energy. I want to be present. I learned that from my dad. You know, my dad used to say, con toda la ponzoña. It means if you're a snake, give it all your venom. Play, you know? And so we split up. You know, half of the band, at that time, we went to New York and Madison Square Garden or whatever it was. And then we find a conga player right there, you know. It's important to, at some point or another in your life, stand up for your own convictions, you know.
Along with that, what I noticed in the book is that you're extremely generous in mentioning all the other musicians that has been in every single band that you put together from this point forward. You remember every player that played with, and the band kept changing. The only thing that didn't change was the name, Santana. And Santana stood for this kind of sound, this progressive sound that was jazz. You played your hits when you wanted to, but this other jazz spiritual. But increasingly, on this trajectory, you started to develop a more spiritual consciousness personally. And that obviously influenced your music. And you at that time you very much dedicated yourself to your spiritual quest under the direction of Sri Chinmoy, a guru that was in New York. Can you talk about him?
Yes, absolutely. You know, there was a time where every person that I knew was either ODing because they were doing this or doing this. You know, and so Jim Morrison's gone, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, like that. You know, they're all leaving because of... Anyway, I said, you know, there's got to be something different for me. So I started reading about Paramahansa Yogananda and listening to John Coltrane, and I stopped smoking weed and started doing juices, you know, and I really wanted to improve. Back then, as now, my consciousness, you know,
thank you.
And I think that when you improve your consciousness, you become more effulgent, more brighter, more luminous. You know, you come into a room and people are like, you know, they see that you have something. Everyone has it. It's just that you're working diligently to get it out, you know. So we attracted Sri Chinmoy, and what one thing, there's many things that he said, but one thing that it was really important to me, They're giving this thing that he said to Jimi Hendrix, but Jimi Hendrix didn't say it. I know because I was there. It was Sweet Chin Moy who said first, when the power of love replaces the love for power, men will have a new name. He also said, to a starving person, food is God. And he also said, and to an aspiring person, only God is the food. So I decided that I wanted to play music to inspire people to aspire. You know, because when you aspire, you want a hug from God, a real kitchen hug, like, ah. And when you get a hug like that, you're able to transform your fear, your illusions, your temptations. You're able to, like, all of a sudden, you claim your divinity, you know. And so the more I learn about Sri Chin Moy and other spiritual books, the more I realize that I have the power, like you, to create miracles and blessings. If I was talking to Dolores Huerta, and she said, ¿Tú sabes lo peor que le puede pasar a la gente? And I said, yeah. She says, you know the worst thing that can happen to people? I go, what? He goes, again, to become cynical. Because nothing grows in cement. So I utilize music to soften people's hearts so that you're able to open without fear and allow this light to meet yours and God's. And when you do that, you're unstoppable. Thank you.
So at this point, you're studying with Sri Chin Moy, and you're developing your spiritual identity. It's influencing your music. You've had, what, 10, 12 albums out at this point, somewhere around there? And you're starting to become luminous. And Clive Davis enters your life again record company. I think it was Arista. Starts talking to you about working together again and to put together with other musicians. But younger musicians who kind of maybe you've heard of but didn't really know their music that well. And Clive both were astounded that every single person wanted to record with you. Every single person. There wasn't one person that said no. And you came out with an album called Supernatural. Yeah. Supernatural was nominated for 10 Grammys, won 8 Grammys. I mean, there was a time when you couldn't open your refrigerator without hearing Smooth, you know? I mean, you lift up the toilet seat, and forget about it, boom. It was everywhere, and it was such a research and such validation of the way that you conducted your life and your musical trajectory. Can you talk about that, please?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Thank you. My instructions was, we're going to put you on the radio airwaves like you've never been before. And every time you receive an award, say, Kadosh, 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 Adonai Sabayoth. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. Give all the glory to God. So Hebrew people were saying, hey, why are you saying that? You're not even Jewish. And I said, those were my instructions. Kadosh, 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 Adonai Sabayoth. Every single artist, when they came to the studio, they said, before Clive Davis called me, I knew I was going to work with you because everywhere I went, your music was there. In a cab, this, there, and I was like, whoa, what's with Santana? Everywhere I go is Santana. So by the time Clive Davis called, I said, yeah, you know. I feel really, really grateful, very honored, you know, because we're not done yet. We're into creating music call it frequency of compassion. With everything that's happened with the riots, we need to create music that dismantles violence and anger and fear, you know?
That leads me into my last question is, as every musician, every actor, every writer tries to develop a particular voice or a particular tone mm-hmm. that defines them, that as soon as you hear it, you know who that person is. You can hear you play guitar anywhere you are in the world. Turn on the radio, oh, that's Santana. It takes
two. In one note,
you know, that's Santana. And that leads into my last question, which is the title of your book. What is the universal tone?
The universal tone is a frequency of light, unity, harmony. It's a frequency that transcends the beast, anger, fear. It's just love and fear, you know? The universal tone for me is John Coltrane, Bob Marley, Michael Jackson, me, and people like us. Thank you. Thank you so much.
So,
you want to buy some questions?
Yeah, I know you're dying to find out. So we're going to take questions. There's a microphone set up over here and over here. If you have a question, come over and enunciate it. And we shall answer it, or Carlos will answer it. Yes, ma'am, over here. Ma'am, sir, whichever you are, I can't see. Hello? All right, let's try over here.
We can take one right over here.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Cynthia. I am your peer. Your Welcome album was the soundtrack for my soul for a number of years, and I keep remembering love, devotion, and surrender. Can you tell me about the creation of that beautiful, beautiful album?
Thank you for asking that. That was the name of the path for Sri Chinmoy. You must have love for God and devotion and surrender. So it was kind of like West Point or the Marines, the discipline. It was no nonsense, you know, really focused. Love, devotion, and surrender, you know, with Leon Thomas, was a lot of people were scratching their heads. They thought I lost my mind playing this kind of music opposed to, you know, Oye Como Va or whatever. But for me, it was very nurturing. Thank you.
Thank you. Over here, we have a question over here on this side.
Dale.
Go ahead. Speak now. I'm pointing to you. Do you have a question?
Okay.
Mic is not on? All right, you have a question. Go ahead, honey.
Orale.
Thank you.
Now, Carlos, I love you.
Thank you.
My brother introduced me to your music, loved your music, played your music, and when he passed away, we played Samba Pati for him. So I feel like he's with us here because the DJ played it before you came on. And my son plays your music now. And I just want to know, I'm a Chicana from Orange County, baby boomer, as they say, and I want to know if you're going to come to Orange County in 2015.
Yes, absolutely. We were just there this summer. We'll do it again. Yeah.
I got a question I want to ask you.
Okay.
Do you identify yourself as a Mexicano, a Chicano, or something else?
All of them and none of them.
Okay.
I am a beam of light. You are a beam of light. And then they can define you as a penguin or a squirrel or a Chicano or Irish or whatever. But first, you are a beam of light. And if you stay with that, you're going to be really better off.
Andale, ever ready. Andale, we have a question over here.
Greetings, Carlos.
Hi.
Trisha.
Hi, Tricia.
I've been a longtime fan. I had my Santana picture poster up on the wall in Oakland. And it was you and Mandrill that introduced me to Latin, the Latin sound. I appreciated that you spoke about the blues. I'm going to speak the name of the geezer, Ed Archer, that had a longtime blues show on KPFK. Blues is truly the foundation. Can you speak to your friendship with one of my favorite musicians, Miles Davis?
Of course. Miles Davis, to me, was the ultimate divine rascal. He was a person that when angels came and say, God, did you know what Miles did now? He'd go, yeah, I know. It's Miles. Leave him alone. You know? So Miles was a person who wouldn't take stuff from anybody before the Black Panthers or black women or anything. He was a person who was very, very convicted with not taking anything from anyone. And his conviction to me is supreme because, you know, he actually did change music 8 times. He changed it by himself. Kind of Blue, which is the ultimate in jazz, ultimate supreme. Bitches Brew, you can't even say that nowadays.
Sure.
You know, they on the corner, Sketches. How many children were born to Sketches of Spain? Or conceived, you know? So I love him because, but I gotta tell you something, you know, he gave me a great gift twice. I would come to see him, and I gotta stand up for this. Like he would go like this. In front of everybody, Quincy Jones, everybody. But he comes straight to me. And you know the way they greet in the Maoris in New Zealand, they put their nose right next to your nose. So he come over and put his face right here, and then he put his hands like this behind my neck. And then he lift up his feet, and he was hanging. And I'm like, oh. And so I'm holding him with his feet are like this. And everybody's like, damn, what's with Miles and Carlos, you know? And then he would say, it means so much that you're here. And I was like, whoa. Damn. You know? Twice. So it made me realize that he saw something in me. I'm very, very grateful. He believed in me, and he called me through 3 o'clock in the morning to encourage me. I don't think he had that many friends like that. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to say I saw you guys in 73 at the Nicaragua earthquake at the Forum.
Yes.
And you guys, thank you, Cheech and Chong. You guys were so good.
Thank you.
Anyways, my question is, your album covers are really amazing. Could you just tell us the influence of how you came up with all that great creativity?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You basically go like this. The angels kiss it, and the right artist shows up. You know, you have to just trust, you know. Trust is thrust. Everyone needs spiritual velocity. If you don't believe, you're crawling. If you trust and you believe, you're accelerating. Utilize your belief and your trust, your hope and your faith. Without that, nada pasa. Mm-hmm. Right? Hey.
First, I want to say thank you for the things that you do for our school.
Thank you.
Our school is Carlos Santana Arts Academy.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And my question is, when did you start becoming more and more famous?
Yeah, when?
I'm still trying to do that. I don't know how to do that. I just play.
What, what inspired you to play music, and why do you like playing it so much?
Music is one of the highest forms of art to invite people to claim their own divinity. I don't like the song Amazing Grace so much because it talks about a wretched sinner. Ain't nothing wretched about me. Ain't nothing wretched about you. God created beauty, grace, elegance, divinity. When you start thinking that you're wretched or unworthy, all that kind of stuff is what Bob Marley called mental slavery. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. Say to yourself, I am as God created me, and God only is good and love and light. So when you play Amazing Grace, when people die, they also play Redemption Song. It's the same song by a guy who used to sell black people, a pirate. And Redemption Song is about black people who were sold, old pirates, they rabbi, you know, it's the same song, you know. I know a lot of people get upset when I say stuff like that, but I don't see myself. I have a lot of things to outgrow and to shed, but I don't want to ever identify as a wretched anything. That's not about God. God is beautiful. God is mighty. And you are mighty. You know the difference between conviction and arrogance, spiritual conviction. Claim your spiritual conviction. Roar like a lion. You know, don't put the tail between your legs and, oh, you know, I'm a wretched and I'm a sinner. Man, you're cooperating with becoming useless. Don't become useless, become magnanimous. Use your light. I invite you to use your light. God gave it to you personally. Thank you.
You have another question on this side here?
Carlos.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been playing guitar for 35 years. You've been more than an inspiration. You've been a mentor to me. And I, again, thank you. I have a two-part question, real quick. Tell us about how your rig has evolved over time so that now you have this amazing tone that you bring to your audience every night. And also, tell us how you channel and what you do to channel the energy that you bring when you are improvising a solo, in particular on stage.
Well, thank you so much. My sound has changed because I utilize three amplifiers, not to be louder, but like I learned this from Pavarotti, you know, Luciano Pavarotti, you know. So he has this voice, which is head tones, chest tones, and bass. So I use this amplifier, that amplifier, to create a whole kind of sound. Like Stevie Ray, I learned from Stevie Ray, you know. It's not, you don't use three amplifiers to become louder. You use amplifiers that got high, middle, and low frequency. What I do try to channel is, I say to myself every day, people are flowers, music is water, yo soy una manguera. I am a hose. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. One more.
I like you, first of all.
Aww.
And second, I love what you did to our school, and I really love it because I get to play all the time. Yeah. And also, I need to tell you where were you born?
I This is the most divine, pure blessing I ever received. Thank you. To be acknowledged by innocence, for someone to see something good in me, you can have the Grammys. You can have all of that stuff. You know, when someone with that innocence and pristine purity acknowledge something beautiful in you, you know. What was the last question?
Where were you born?
Oh, when was I born? I was born in Mexico, Autlan, Jalisco. And I'm very, very grateful. It's a very, very beautiful town. Gracias.
Thank you. Over here we got one more on this side.
Hello, I just want to first off and say thank you so much, both of you, for being here. And also, thank you for mentioning your mom, because I'm a mom of a 10-and-a-half-year-old son who's driving me literally out of my mind. Literally. But I have definitely played your music for her many times. But my question is, I grew up, my brother was a drummer, and we had a lot of jazz in our family. And two really of my, besides you, of my favorite musicians passed away this year, Joe Sample and Bill Evans. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious if you've ever worked with them or what your vibe on that was.
Thank you for asking that. I think it was 1994 that I was invited to play at Montreux Jazz Festival. And I played with Joe Sample, Joe Sawinul, and Joe Henderson in one day. And I was like, what's with the Joes? You know, what's happening with Joe? You know, hey, you know, I asked God, hey, what's going on with Joe, you know? And what was really funny is because Claude Knopf said to me, oh, you know, listen, you know, I want to know if you would be open to play with Joe Henderson. I said, are you kidding, Joe Henderson? And so, but Joe Henderson had a different kind of thing about him with me, you know, it's like, so when he heard that, you know, Claude Knobs wanted us to do something, it was kind of like, kind of thing, you know, like me play with Santana kind of thing, you know. And so he came to the room, the dressing room, and he said, you know, he wouldn't even look at me like, man, you know, they want us to do this thing. And, like, rah, rah, rah. And I said, well, Joe, why don't we play this song? And I put the song on, and it was a song called The Love Thing from Apache. And it was Coleman Hawkins. And he heard it and he goes, oh, that's, that. I says, man, you gotta know who that is. He goes, yeah, of course I know who that is. Man, that's, I go, Coleman Hawkins. He goes, oh. I says, why don't we do that song? He goes, you wanna play that song? I said, yeah, let's do that song. Now check this out, because there's some jazz musicians who are a little snobby.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like we're a dead stinky fish or something, you know? So we had just done that, and then I'm going into another gig in Vienna, and then Charlie Hayden says, hey, I heard you play last night with Joe Henderson. What, pray tell, did you guys do together? You know, kind of thing. I'm like, oh, shit, you know? So I said, put the tape recorder in that song. And he goes, you play that song with Joe Henderson? I go, yeah. He goes, he pulls out this folio. He goes, we got the lead sheet music. We're going to play it tonight.
Oh, baby.
You know, so God works in not mysterious ways.
Yeah, yeah.
He works in a very direct way. I'm very grateful that a lot of musicians have accepted me. The ones that they don't, they have issues. It's not my problem. Thank you. We're just about there? Okay.
We have time for one more question, I'm being told here. Okay,
hello.
One more question.
Hi, yes, my name is Nicole Sosa.
I know.
And it's an extreme honor to be here.
Thank you.
And I brought my daughter sitting in the front row with me, who's 19, and I've always followed the song Wings of Grace.
Yes.
And I've dedicated it to her entire life. I want to know where that song came from, because spiritually it's guided me and it's helped me through life. And it's a song that I use daily to inspire her through her life and through my life. So if you can give me just a little bit of history about that song, I think I'll forever embed it into my soul.
Thank you so much. All the instrumental songs that I do, whether it's Sound Pati, Europa, or Wings of Grace, they tell a story of connecting with your own light. You don't have to die to go to heaven. You can connect with your light by repeating, I am not the body, I am free, I still am as God created me. So, I remember the melody immediately. And I'm telling the same story, you know, like the Samba Pati or Europa. I'm always inviting people to claim, please claim every day, morning, noon, and night. Claim your light. It's not just Jesus or Buddha or Krishna who have it. You have it. You are it. Manifest it. I love you so much. Peace.
Thank you. Carlos Santana. Thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.